Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines a recent federal court decision which ruled that the Bush administration's NSA warrantless surveillance program was unconstitutional. Jeff Cohen, author of the book Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, who discusses how media corporations decide the time devoted and viewpoints presented in covering news stories. And Elizabeth Cook, a housing activist, who describes some of the hardships facing low-income tenants in New Orleans 1 year after the devastating destruction caused by Hurricane Katrina. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
3 months after a peace deal was signed in Darfur, the war-torn region of Western Sudan, the level of violence has only gotten worse. Rebel factions are now fighting each other, and 11 humanitarian workers have been killed since the peace agreement was signed. The 7,000-member African Union force has been unable to stem the violence. The United Nations Security Council is now debating a resolution to place a 20,000-soldier peacekeeping force in Darfur to replace the African Union troops. The deployment of UN peacekeepers is actively opposed by Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who has compared the UN blue helmets to a foreign occupation. The United Nations has expressed concern over the growing humanitarian crisis in Darfur. Aid agencies can reach only 50% of the people displaced by the violence. Over the last 3 years, over 300,000 people have been killed in Darfur, and 2 million people have been forced to flee their homes. Smith College professor Eric Reeves, a leading Darfur advocate, blamed the Bush administration for the bungled Darfur deal. As Reeves told the Los Angeles Times, they wanted to get the deal done soon so it could be taken off the diplomatic table. This is Rwanda in slow motion. If we really believe genocide is occurring, it's morally intolerable. While global attention has focused on surging AIDS rates in Africa and Asia, the American HIV infection rate has remained the same for 15 years. The steady number of 40,000 AIDS cases in the United States has perplexed AIDS researchers. New drugs and prevention strategies have been tried but have had little impact on the spread of the HIV virus. According to the Washington Post, HIV in the U.S. peaked in the mid-1980s with 160,000 cases. With intense education among gay men and drug abusers, the infection rate fell to 40,000 cases in 1990. It has not changed since. Chris Collins of the Open Society Institute has blamed government inaction for the persistent level of infection causing needless deaths and for failing our own citizens in the domestic response to this epidemic. Government surveys show that young black male homosexuals are at the highest risk for HIV infection. The CDC found 46% of these men engaging in risky sex were HIV positive, and two-thirds of them were unaware that they were infected. Yet AIDS outreach in the African American community is hampered by a lack of government funds. Rudy Giuliani is often referred to as America's mayor for his response to the 9/11 terrorist attack that destroyed the World Trade Center. Over the last 5 years, Giuliani has milked that reputation into a profitable consulting business and is currently making plans to run for the Republican nomination for president in 2008. But Giuliani's record on terrorism before 9/11 is spotty as New York City's mayor. For 7 years, he failed to work with federal prosecutors on issues related to terrorism. In addition, Giuliani didn't rework emergency preparations at the Trade Center towers after the 1993 bombing that killed 6 people and injured 1,000. Worst of all, Giuliani put the city's $61 million Emergency Operations Center on the 23rd floor of the No. 7 World Trade Center building. The Operations Center was destroyed in the 9/11 attack. In retrospect, better communication among first responders could have saved the lives of police and firefighters who died during the evacuation of the Twin Towers. According to the American Prospect magazine, 9/11 families have bitterly complained about Giuliani's neglect of emergency preparedness. On 9/11, firefighters were using the same radios that had failed during the response to the 1993 Trade Center bombing. Furthermore, Giuliani, as mayor, failed to order a full-scale interagency drill in the towers before the 9/11 attack. The destruction of the Emergency Operations Center was a preventable tragedy. A viable alternative site was available in Brooklyn, yet Giuliani chose the site in Lower Manhattan over the objections of fire and police commanders. America's mayor wanted the center to be in walking distance of City Hall. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
Judge Anna Diggs Taylor of the U.S. District Court in Detroit, Michigan, ruled in an August 17th decision that President Bush's National Security Agency warrantless surveillance program was unconstitutional. Judge Diggs, who ordered the immediate termination of the program, which monitored American citizens' international phone and email communications, declared that the operation violates the separation of powers doctrine, the Administrative Procedures Act, the First and Fourth Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, and the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The Justice Department said it would appeal the decision, maintaining that the program was a valuable tool in preventing terrorist attacks. The case was brought by the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Washington and Detroit branches of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and Greenpeace. President Bush's domestic spying program was first revealed by the New York Times in December 2005, after the paper delayed reporting the story for a year after the White House requested that it not be published. In a move opposed by many civil liberties advocates, Senator Arlen Specter, Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is proposing congressional legislation that would explicitly authorize the president's warrantless NSA wiretap program retroactively. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, who discusses Judge Diggs' decision and the ongoing struggle to defend the Constitution.
The case brought by the ACLU in Detroit was filed on behalf of some attorneys who have contact with people overseas that the government suspects might be involved with terrorism, and also on behalf of some journalists who, in connection with news gathering and reporting, are talking to people overseas that the government suspects might be involved with terrorism. And the case claimed that the government's action, that the president's action in doing electronic surveillance had interfered with their ability to do their jobs because they had to fear that they might be overheard by the government, and that the program was illegal and unconstitutional, that it violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which Congress had passed precisely in order to create an opportunity for the government to do electronic surveillance in national security cases, but one that required them to seek a warrant. So what the president's doing violates that act, and it also violates the First and Fourth Amendments to the Constitution. And the judge, Judge Taylor in Detroit, ruled in favor of the ACLU plaintiffs. She said they had standing to bring the case, that the government's argument that the court would have to examine secret evidence in order to review the case was incorrect. As a matter of fact, she said she'd looked at the secret evidence, and the secret evidence was not necessary in order to resolve the case. And finally, she ruled that the government's program violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and violated the First and Fourth Amendments.
There are moves, as you know, by the Republican-controlled Congress to change the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that would have been the law that President Bush violated in these warrantless wiretaps that were put on American citizens. Arlen Specter, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is talking about giving the president lots more power to do surveillance without warrants in advance, leaving a larger window of time that the original FISA Act did allow the White House. But what do you make of the Republican Congress's moves to allow the president more leeway in the FISA Act?
Well, Senator Spector and the Republicans in Washington are proceeding on two fronts. One is to expand the president's powers by passing a bill that presumably would give him that power. And the other is that Senator Spector is advocating sending this dispute about what the president has already done, passing legislation to send that dispute to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court instead of having it resolved by the courts that are established by Article 3 of the Constitution. And both of these plans are ill-conceived and would not serve the American people well. With regard to the notion that when the president breaks the law, what we should do is change the law so that he's not breaking it anymore, I just don't think that's a very sensible way of doing business. And it gives away the freedom of American people to talk on their telephones without fear that the government is listening.
The Bush administration and previous Reagan and Bush number one administrations have made a lot of appointments to federal courts across the country. What kind of concern do you have about the survival of our Constitution, given that many of these appointees are quite hostile to civil liberties in general and some of these protections that the Bush administration have been challenging in particular?
You know, the issues that are on the table now are really the same issues that were on the table in 1786. They are the great themes of the American experiment in democracy. How much power can the executive exercise? When is the executive going to be checked, either by the Congress or by the courts, from exercising too much power? How much fear do we have to have of our own government, and how can we channel that fear in a constructive direction by having a system of separation of powers? These are the great questions of American democracy, and I'm afraid that many of the men and women who are influential today in resolving these questions don't have the same kind of concern about democratic values that motivated the people who founded this country and who wrote our Constitution. And that's something that every American really needs to understand and be concerned about and take some action about. People should be writing to their senators now and to their congresspeople now to say, let's let this dispute be settled by the courts. Let's find out from the courts whether the president has the constitutional authority to break the law.
That was Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild and professor of constitutional law at Boston Suffolk Law School. Contact the National Lawyers Guild at area code 212-679-5100 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. With the highest monthly death toll in Iraq since the 2003 U.S. invasion, a bloody resurgence of Taliban fighters in Afghanistan, a fragile ceasefire in Lebanon, and a federal judge's ruling that President Bush's domestic surveillance program is unconstitutional, the biggest news story in American media is the questionable confession of a man in a 10-year-old murder case. A media riot followed reports that John Mark Carr, an American living in Thailand, had confessed to the 1996 murder of JonBenet Ramsey, a 6-year-old beauty queen living in Boulder, Colorado. After the story broke, television news, especially cable news channels, broadcast almost round-the-clock coverage of the case, virtually blocking out all other critical news stories in the United States and from around the world. Television executives argue that they're only giving American TV viewers what they want, but media critics assert that journalism has long ago lost out to the entertainment value of scandal and sensationalism, which is cheap to produce and inoffensive to those in power. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jeff Cohen, founder of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Cohen, author of the book Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, discusses his insider's view of how media corporations decide the time devoted and viewpoints presented in covering news stories.
Clearly, what's not important is war and peace, economic exploitation, environmental degradation, constitutional freedoms. What is important is this soap opera of a 10-year-old murder case involving the 6-year-old beauty pageant winner. That's more important than all these other issues combined. And when I was working at MSNBC and working at Fox News, I used to take part in this nonsense. And I can remember, you know, in 1999, the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal had ended. Clinton had been acquitted at the impeachment trial, and cable news was looking around for their next blockbuster. And they hoped it would be a trial in the JonBenet Ramsey case. She'd been killed 3 years earlier. And the DA announced he was going to have a press conference announcing the findings of the grand jury in Boulder, Colorado. And cable news executives across the land were holding their breath, thinking they would get a ratings bonanza from an O.J. Simpson-like trial in the JonBenet case. And then the DA comes forward and he says, we don't have any evidence, enough evidence to indict anyone. And I was on Fox News about a day or two later, and I said that I worried there would be mass suicides among cable news executives because their trial that they'd been awaiting for so long wasn't going to happen. So in a sense, what you're seeing this week is them trying to get a payoff on the JonBenet case that they didn't get in 1999. It's pathological. You know, we have a country where most people can't identify their member of Congress, but they know every detail in the JonBenet Ramsey case. And that's the way the corporate executives who run, the corporate owners of the mainstream media, that's Rupert Murdoch, that's General Electric, that's Disney, that's Time Warner, they like a society that way, where we're just passive spectators instead of being active, informed citizens.
Well, Jeff Cohen, having been inside the cable media system, as you were as a senior producer and a commentator involved in some of the nuts and bolts, take us behind the scenes. What exactly goes on? Is this like a strictly monetary calculation that if we cover this court case about the surveillance program of the Bush administration being unconstitutional, we will not make as much money than if we cover the JonBenet Ramsey case, you know, 24 hours, 7 days a week?
Every decision is based on a lot of factors. If you do that story about warrantless wiretapping and you're at MSNBC or CNN or Fox, if you're at a more mainstream centrist network, well, you're worried about offending the powers that be. You're worried about irritating the Bush administration. If you do serious investigative reporting, maybe you'll offend a corporation and you'll lose some sponsorship. So it's clearly understood in TV news that there's certain stories that can get you into trouble. But when you do a JonBenet Ramsey case, there's no downside. No one in power is going to get upset with you. No sponsor is going to leave because they don't like your coverage. And it's cheap. There's nothing cheaper than to have so-called legal experts going on and on, hour after hour after hour. Just they're talking for free. They don't. Most of them don't get paid. And again, it's got very little downside.
Well, Jeff, you've been in hundreds of debates on this very topic. And one of the things that the media executives and the media owners always come back with when their coverage is criticized of these sensational issues, they say, this is what people want to watch. Simply stated, the ratings are higher because this is what people want. We're only giving people what they want in this market society.
You know, you mentioned the new book I've got coming out. In that book, I describe what happened to us at MSNBC when I was a senior producer on the most watched program on MSNBC, The Phil Donahue Show. And everyone knew we could get ratings if we counter-programmed against the other channels and we put on people that were critics of the upcoming invasion of Iraq. We would have been the only place that regularly featured skeptics about weapons of mass destruction existing in Iraq. And it is in my debates, and it was continuous for months when I worked at MSNBC, I made these arguments that were quite plausible about how we could build our ratings if we gave a different slant on the news. And it didn't take me too long to realize that they didn't want ratings. There were certain things that were far more important than ratings, and that was making sure that Phil Donahue didn't have an anti-war show. It was making sure that we didn't offend the Bush administration. In the last months of the Donahue show, we were ordered by management, every time we put on a guest who was anti-war, we had to put on two guests that were pro-war. It was a management dictate. So they can give you this rhetoric that we just give the viewers what they want, but in what I saw up close, there were very many stories that were off limits. There were guests that were off limits. There were topics they didn't want us to do too tough on, not because they were worried they would be snoozy and wouldn't get ratings, but because they were worried it would get ratings and it would cause other kinds of problems.
That was Jeff Cohen, founder of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. His latest book is titled Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Visit FAIR's website at www.fair.org. One year after Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans, fewer than half the city's former residents have returned. Among its former public housing tenants, a much smaller percentage have come back. All the housing projects in the city, whether or not they were flooded, were closed for most of the past year, and most of the residents are still scattered in cities around Louisiana and throughout the South. HUD, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, has announced it would demolish most of the units. But the Housing Authority of New Orleans, or HANO, has now reopened a few of the projects, and more residents are returning despite great obstacles. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Elizabeth Cook, a New Orleanian who works with a group called the United Front for Affordable Housing, comprised of public housing residents and community activists. She describes some of the hardships low-income tenants in New Orleans have faced and what they're doing about it.
We've got somewhere between 600 and 800 people back in public housing. But prior to Katrina, of course, we had about 5,000 families in public housing, about 20,000 people. So this is a drop in a bucket of what the population in public housing was before the storm.
Isn't it true that Alfonso Jackson, the secretary of HUD, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, announced that HUD's going to demolish many of the housing developments in New Orleans?
Alfonso Jackson stated way back in October after Katrina that there would be fewer black people. He said it, you know, bluntly in New Orleans. And since then, he's made every effort to ensure that his policies bring that about. He has stated that Lafitte Housing Development, which had between 800 and 900 families, St. Bernard Housing Development, which had about 1,300 families, and part of B.W. Cooper, which was about, I'd say, 900 families will be demolished. And some of these developments were not that badly damaged by the storm. So it's not a question of can they be repaired. It's a question of the federal government lacks the will to repair them. And we believe it's a conscious effort to keep certain people from returning, namely public housing, working class people.
Well, there is a more recent philosophy that says it doesn't make sense to warehouse poor people altogether in densely populated projects, and, you know, that it's better urban policy and better for the tenants themselves if they can have more options for where to live.
Well, I guess it depends on your point of view, because if you're a working-class, low-income, working poor person, you know, a warehouse is better than no house, and that's what a lot of people are facing in New Orleans. It's interesting to me that the argument is always put forth that we should not have concentrations of poverty in, you know, high-rises, public housing high-rises or public housing developments, yet there are concentrations of wealth in wealthy neighborhoods, and apparently that's okay. Now, we have corporate crime that's certainly running rampant in this country, people profiteering off of, war and Katrina misery, but it's okay for them to live in gated communities. But when it comes to, you know, the working poor that need affordable housing, we have to disperse them in order to help them. And that makes no sense to me, because dispersing poverty doesn't solve it.
Elizabeth Cook, what is the Housing Authority of New Orleans, or HANO's, plan for housing these folks when they do return?
HUD has announced that Section 8 vouchers will be a one-to-one replacement of public housing. And everyone knows that this is a fallacy. Section 8 is not an adequate replacement for public housing because, number one, residents have to find landlords willing to take the voucher. It's not a guarantee, because you're handed a voucher is no guarantee that you're going to find housing. And number two, you know, there's a lot of costs involved with Section 8. You've got to come up with deposits for utilities. It's a much, much greater expense for the working poor, and many of them are struggling. We've heard many stories about, you know, utilities getting shut off in Houston. Some people are moving back here. They'd rather be homeless here than homeless in Houston, and that's what people are facing right now. And we think the problem is going to get worse as the FEMA rental subsidies are being cut off.
Do you know what the deadline is for when the FEMA payments run out?
We know of one woman, for example, whose hotel subsidy will end at the end of August, and she has decided she's not going to wait. She has reoccupied her public housing unit at the C.J. Pete Housing Development. So she's back cleaning up her unit along with several of her neighbors, and they're not waiting for HANO to reopen C.J. Pete. They're going to reopen it themselves, and they're very courageous and determined. But they also feel desperate because their housing is running out.
I assume there are no utilities in those units, the ones that aren't officially reopened?
That's right. They're going to tough it out, bringing their own water. I think they have, you know, some relatives in the city that they can spend some of the time with. But they are determined to get their units ready for reoccupation. People have come back to their units, cleaned them up themselves, moved back in, but, you know, HANO tells them that they're in their units illegally, even though they had legal leases to their units prior to Katrina.
That was Elizabeth Cook of the United Front for Affordable Housing in New Orleans. Contact the United Front at area code 504-520-9521 or visit the group's website at www.survivorsvillage.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tok. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.